Public Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We are unpacking why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Zev Carlin Newman. Zev's writing has been ranked one of the best commencement speeches ever by NPR, listed as a bestseller by the New York Times, and also called biased and ignorant by an internet commentator. Zev founded Just Right Communications after a decade and a half helping leaders tell their stories and advance their agendas, from the C-suite to Capitol Hill, and from the campaign trail to the White House. Zev has served as a speechwriter for Secretary of State Antony Blinken, domestic policy advisor Susan Rice, for Pete Buttigieg's historic 2020 presidential campaign, and for no names like former President Barack Obama and Vice President Kamala Harris. Zev, I'm so happy to have you here today. Thank you for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for creating this space to talk about public service.
It's my pleasure. So let's get started. I really love to just hear where people grew up and what their family was like so I can begin to psychoanalyze them. So where are you from, Zev?
Yeah, I grew up in California, born in Southern California, but grew up largely in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I'm a NorCal guy. I'm now on this coast, but, you know, very much shaped by the chill, laid back West Coast vibe.
I have so many Californians on this show. There's like some kind of a theme emerging.
40 million of us. Yeah. Somehow we make our way to DC and into public service.
What was your family like?
Yeah. I think we were fairly close, kind of, you know, your relatively typical suburban upper middle class family, I suppose. My dad was a molecular biologist who eventually, left academia and spun off a couple startups. My mom was a rabbi, at one point congregational rabbi, and then she was one of the deans for religious life at Stanford University. So doing a lot of interfaith work and, you know, tending to the spiritual and emotional well-being of students. That definitely had an impact on, me thinking about speeches, because her sermons were effectively that. I have a sister who's 22 months older. So for a short window between December and late January, she's only 1 year ahead of me. We were close growing up. She's a teacher and administrator for a early childhood education center right now. It was the four of us.
Very cool. See, this is why I asked this question, because I didn't know before now that your mom was a rabbi, and it makes a lot of sense that you would be inspired by a similar career path where you get to not only connect with people, but tell a story, like help people see things in a different way. So I think that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then how did you end up finding your way into speech writing?
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, growing up, I would listen to, my mom's sermons, and she was very much, a believer that, like, they'd given her a platform and she should use it. And, I remember, I think 2004, Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur service that she was doing, on the campus of Stanford University. This was the fall, so it was right before the presidential election. And she basically gave a vote for Kerry speech sermon, not in such partisan terms, but, very much kind of mapping Jewish values to what was at stake in the election. And, I remember some people, a few people walking out. Obviously, lots of people appreciated it, but she was kind of a comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable type rabbi, and that definitely played a role in just being like, you say things and people listen, and sometimes they really appreciate it, maybe sometimes they walk out of the room, but
what's your mom's name?
Patricia.
So
Rabbi Patricia Carla Newman.
Rabbi Patricia gave her endorsement. It just wasn't enough to get Carrie over the finish line, but she
sadly,
did.
Sadly, I don't think they heard it in Ohio. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, that was definitely one thread. I'd always been interested in writing and politics and public policy. At one point, probably, I think I remember maybe like seventh or eighth grade, I discovered Tom Friedman, which is kind of funny to think about now. But, you know, I just thought it was like the coolest thing you could write. He wrote a column about going to the DMZ, actually. And, you know, writing about, well, actually, I think there was he made some linkage between the DMZ and then the security wall and, you know, Israel, presently. But, you know, I was like, this is great. You can, you know, write what you think and millions of people read it and maybe some of them, you know, listen. So for a little while, you know, I was imagining maybe a career path in journalism, you know, thinking, you know, that it might be nice to eventually, yeah, be some kind of, you know, opinion columnist, though obviously recognizing that was not like, you know, something they handed everyone. You had to be Jerusalem bureau chief for a while or whatever.
Right.
And then, you know, I started undergrad in 2007, and the 2008 primary, you know, was already underway, and this Barack Obama guy was given some pretty great speeches. And, you know, not only did I find, you know, the speeches, you know, incredibly inspiring, but, you know, because his rhetoric was kind of so central to his appeal, there were, you know, there were profiles of, you know, our other podcasting friends now, you know, John Favreau and, you know, people who, you know, were helping him, you know, craft those words. And, you know, so I think partly that helped just kind of raise the awareness for me that, you know, this was a career path. And I was watching a lot of the West Wing. I was studying history and political science, or 20th century American political history. So, you know, reading FDR, JFK, MLK speeches and, you know, looking at them as primary sources in my classes, but also just kind of for fun on the side, you know, analyzing like, you know, oh, this rhetorical technique, you know, he uses the rule of three here and, you know, this is an allusion to the Gettysburg Address. And so, yeah, I kind of joked that like Sorkin and Sorensen, who was one of JFK's, you know, his great speechwriter and advisor, sort of the twin influences in a lot of respects. And yeah, I think probably by, you know, midway through college, I was already thinking that, you know, this was a way to combine, you know, to be at the intersection of writing and politics and policy, but, you know, to do it more from the inside as opposed to kind of writing about it, reporting on it from the outside.
That is so interesting. And so what do you think makes a really effective speechwriter?
Yeah, it's a good question. Honestly, it's funny, but I think it's almost less the writing. And I think it's a lot about the research. I have a former boss and mentor, Jeff Nussbaum, who was a partner at the speechwriting firm I started out at, West Wing Writers, and you know, went on to be one of Biden's speechwriters. And he, when I first met with him, you know, as a aspiring writer, said, you know, this is maybe a little bit of a generalization, but like you can kind of teach anybody to write, but like the research instincts and sort of, you know, knowing it when you see it. Like you're reading a Wikipedia page or scrolling through some, you know, Census Bureau data or something, and you're like, oh, like that's the nugget that like stands out to me. And then, you know, ergo, like I'll bet somebody listening in the audience would, you know, also be struck by, you know, the fact that we waste football stadiums worth of food, or that, you know, this really cool thing happened in this same place, you know, 50 years earlier or whatever. So, you know, another good friend and mentor of mine, Terry Zuplat, who has a great book, Say It Well, like, I don't know, $30 on Amazon, you should check it out. But he has this rule. He calls the 50-25-25 rule for writing speeches, and that first 50% is how much time he thinks you should actually devote to the research and the thinking about what you're going to write. And then it's actually only a quarter of your time devoted to, to getting the words on paper, and the last 25 is, to revise. But, I think that speaks to how important it is to kind of, get the material, whether that's, from talking to your principal or reading some, Brookings white papers or, reading the news, that, so much of what you end up saying is shaped by that initial research. And then the other thing I think is a really key part of being an effective speechwriter, is like your ability to kind of imagine yourself into other people's shoes. And this goes both ways, right? It's like you're writing for your boss, who, in some cases I've worked with principals really closely and been in the room with them for meetings and, talk to them about, oh, I just read an interesting, column today, or like this book is on my nightstand, and you know what's in their head and their family and all this stuff. And then there are times where like you're writing for someone who's super busy and you maybe get, 45 minutes to be like, here's the draft that I pulled together without a ton of input from you on the front end. What do you think?
That needs to be in their
So,
voice too, which is
right. And
challenging.
so some of it is like, I didn't have a chance to sit down and talk to, Secretary Blinken about, this aspect of his childhood, but you are trying to write about the value of educational exchange, and you know that he grew up in Paris as a kid, and he's obviously said some things in interviews and whatnot, and I've heard him talk to kids at embassy meet and greets and whatnot. But there was a certain element of just like, what must it have been like to be living abroad in Europe at the height of the Transatlantic Alliance and America's leader of this international liberal international order? And was he homesick for the food, or what? Like trying to actually figure out in some cases things that you could potentially have, if you had the chance, gotten really quickly from your boss, but instead you're like reading some French newspaper to be like, what was life like, in Paris at the time? So yeah, the ability to kind of imagine, yeah, you're the person you're writing for and what they must have been thinking in various stages of their life in the event that you didn't get it straight from the horse's mouth. And then the flip side of it is thinking about your audience, your listener, your reader, if it's a book or, an op-ed, and just sort of trying to visualize, I am talking to a bunch of like stressed out, angry parents who have been under lockdown with COVID, and they've been trying to get their 5-year-olds to like sit and take a Zoom lesson, and like how crazy making that must be. And so when we're talking about, COVID policies and vaccinations and restrictions, like that is all part of the background. And like, even if I myself haven't experienced this, particular facet of life, what must it have been like? So there's this element of just trying to, really write in a way that, think about how it's going to be received, who the people are that are listening to it. And I guess kind of broadly, you're telling a story, and and sometimes that actually means, including stories and anecdotes, because those tend to be things that stick. By the end, people will just be like totally convinced, like you've anticipated the objections, and they're like, how could it be otherwise? Of course we want to, pass this bill or vote for this person. So yeah, I think the ability to do the research, to kind of imagine what people are like who are going to be hearing the speech, and to make that argument is what makes someone really effective.
Well, and so, okay, I hear you saying the research is important,
Yeah.
but I also hear that you have to be basically like an empathy Jedi. Like, you have to be able to empathize with the person you're writing for, with the people who will be receiving it, even with the other people who have to clear off on the speech that you are writing, which is the hardest part sometimes. And I think you were saying, like, you can teach anyone to write, I guess to some extent, as we've taught ChatGPT how to write. But man, I really feel maybe this is just because I also am a writer, and so I'm very protective of this art. I really feel like it takes, I think the special sauce is in the empathy, and I think that's really hard to replicate. And maybe for people who practice empathy really often, like, it's clear that you do. It comes a second nature to you, but it is not a gift that everybody has or knows how to practice as effectively as you do. And so I think don't sell yourself short on that, because the empathy, I think, is everything. Yeah. I'm wondering, like, was there ever a time where you just felt like you got it so wrong? Like, you wrote something about Tony Blinken's childhood, and he's like, what the hell, Zev? I wasn't craving cheeseburgers when I was in Paris. You're so wrong.
This was actually a writing test to write for Ambassador Rice when she was National Security Advisor, and I had a line about, I cited Taylor Swift, and I was like, you know, my kids are big Taylor Swift fans and whatever. And she, when we said that, she's like, my kids don't listen to Taylor Swift. It's like, okay, lesson learned.
A shot and a miss.
Yeah. And I think you have to have, you know, a certain willingness to go there. I mean, on the one hand, you don't want to, like, you know, especially, and frankly, I've written, one of my friends jokingly called me the voice of strong Black women everywhere. an exaggeration, but, you know, I wrote for Susan Rice twice. I wrote for Kamala Harris. You know, it is obviously a different experience in many ways than one that I've had. And so if you're talking about race and gender and how people are perceived, you know, it is a balancing act to not want to, like, tip over into, you know, stereotypes of how someone must have felt being the only person like them in a room or dealing with misogyny. And fortunately, I think often I'm not going completely off of nothing. And, you know, I have I have some sense from what these principles have said elsewhere. But, you know, yeah, you definitely don't want to be like, then I felt this way about this, like, injustice. And then they're like, that actually is totally misconstruing, like, my experience as, you know, a Black woman.
You do
woman
have
or something.
To be willing to be wrong sometimes. Like, I'm sure there are times where you try something, you try for a Taylor Swift reference, and it lands or it doesn't. And you have to take that shot, because also I think the worst thing in a speech is just being boring. The only kinds of speeches I've written have been for UN Security Council meetings. So they're generally, like, not the most captivating. Even if I tried to write something a little spicy at the beginning, usually by the time it got through the clearance process, everyone told me that I might start an international incident and that we should tone it down. And so maybe I was just writing for the wrong things. I think so many speeches that are attempting not to offend anyone or trying to include everyone's views end up, unfortunately, being really bland. So that must also be a challenge that you have to navigate sometimes, finding that happy medium.
Totally. And the clearance process, as you know, you know, is kind of the enemy of interesting writing. And, you know, it serves a purpose. And fortunately, to the best of my knowledge, I have not started any international incidents as a result of, you know, smart, well-intentioned people, you know, saving me from myself. Like, I don't know if that pun or that joke is, like, really worth the risk. But, you know, you do have to calibrate. Like, I don't want to say at some point you give up, but, like, you know, I probably have started jobs at the NSC or State Department a little more eager to be outside the box and gotten smacked out enough that the time 6 months in, you're like, I'm just going to kind of do it clean, and it might not be as interesting, but I also won't have to rewrite it a bunch after, you know, I get smacked down. Some lessons learned the hard way.
Fine line. Fine line, but you have to have the guts sometimes to go for it and also the wisdom to know when not to. What do you like about speech writing the most? And then also, what do you think is the hardest or most misunderstood thing about speech writing?
So, you know, I mentioned that speech my mom gave where people walked out. And obviously, I guess it's hard. And that reflects the fact that you don't want necessarily people to, you know, fall asleep or walk out. But I think Dick Goodwin, husband of Doris Kearns Goodwin, he just passed away recently, but he was a Kennedy and Johnson speechwriter. And he used to say that, you know, speeches were about moving men, to action or alliance. And, you know, I think one of the things I really like about speech writing is, you know, unlike if you're a straight news reporter or, you know, even like a, you know, feature, you know, journalist or something, speeches and, you know, and op-eds and, you know, typically have a call to action, right? You are trying to get people to do something, you know, to vote for you, to support a policy, to join your coalition to push back on Vladimir Putin. And, you know, I think that just gives some kind of propulsion to the argument you're making. You know, you're not just, you know, we would always say, you know, especially at a place like State, that, you know, we didn't just want to admire the problem. It's really easy to be like, here's 5 minutes on how climate change is going to doom us all, and be like, someone should probably do something about that. And sometimes the call to action, depending on the groundwork that's been laid, sometimes it is weaker. And sometimes you're like, we've just stood up this amazing global coalition to counter synthetic drug threats. And there's all kinds of great working groups and ways to plug in. And this is what we're asking you. You sign on to this, marshal resources, whatever. And then there are times where like, the call to action doesn't amount to that much more than like, we should do something about it. But you at least wanted to lay down a marker that the United States government recognizes that X is a threat, and we still have some work to do to figure out how we're going to address it, but it is something we need to deal with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, particularly as the United States government, I think we also have to be aware of like who we are and how our messages are received. And sometimes even the United States simply saying we're watching this issue is everything.
Yeah. And so you have to adjust, like depending on the issue and the audience, like sometimes just saying, we are calling this out. Well, I mean, frankly, there are dissidents that have been released just because we put out a statement saying we are disappointed or shocked or we condemn the detention of so-and-so.
We're deeply concerned.
Deeply concerned.
That's a good one.
That's dialing it up to the most diplomatic concern. No, and yeah, sometimes that's enough to get someone released. You don't have to say that's why we are taking steps to whatever, like close our embassy in this country. But I do think, one of the things I really like about writing is that you are trying to get people to do something. There is a point to it. And in terms of the hardest parts, I mean, more prosaically, like for me, it's always the logic and the structure. I'll take all these, you know, nuggets that I find, you know, quotes and stats and, you know, bits and pieces from a cable, from a Washington Post article, and just throw it on this document, and then figuring out like how to really, you know, how to sequence it. And, you know, there is obviously there are infinite ways to write about a given issue. Sometimes you might have a principal that's very formulaic in how they want to talk about it. And then what's hard is like, how do we talk about the same content in the same general structure, but have it be different than when we did this award ceremony last year? But yeah, I mean, I think so much of what makes a speech compelling is, you know, kind of that logical sequencing. And I'm a little ADD, and sometimes I just want to jump in, like write myself into a cul-de-sac. So you need to kind of step back and make sure that you can see from A to B to C. And then I guess what's hard kind of more existentially as a speechwriter, I think the first big issue I feel like myself and a lot of us are confronting is just the information environment, this really polluted information environment and kind of a breakdown of a shared reality, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Reagan could be like, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And today you'd have somebody being like, there is no wall, that's a deep fake, or this is a psyop or a false flag. And so it's like, how do you try to communicate when we don't even, like, it's one thing to say, we all think it's a problem that sea levels are rising and Miami's going to be underwater in a century. What do we do about this? And some people are like, well, we shouldn't raise taxes to deal with it. We should address it through innovation, right? Like, you can quibble on like the specifics and stuff, but you have some people who just kind of don't inhabit the same reality and like, don't think that these things that using objective metrics are a problem, if they don't even think it's a problem, it's hard to get people to coalesce around a solution. So trying to figure out how to communicate in that kind of balkanized, siloed society that we're in is tough. And it obviously, sometimes you're preaching to the choir and you're speaking to a group of USAID staff who understand why development is important, and sometimes you're making your pitch to people who are going to be skeptical. And then the other big existential question is, you mentioned ChatGPT. I think we are, when I was at State, we were beta testing some AI tools, and I think the thinking was quite smart. It was There's obviously a lot of work that our dedicated, talented FSOs and civil servants are doing that is pretty mechanical. And, you know, nothing wrong with outsourcing some of that, automating some of that in the hopes that the things that humans do best, like getting out into the field, meeting with people, if you're in an embassy or something like that, is something that, in theory, a person can do a lot better. And so I think State, for one, is trying to figure out how do we kind of automate the stuff, the huge number of hours that go into like generating reports for Congress. Maybe that can be taken off somebody's plate so that free them up to do the work of diplomacy that only a person can do. But as far as writing, there's kind of a fine line between like our call readouts are pretty formulaic and like, sure, let's outsource that. You know, for research, for thinking, right? You can test, you could say, I'm trying to come up with paragraph that makes this case. What are some good proof points? Or can you help me find statistics on X, and you can streamline the research process. You can test some assumptions. You can really be, I think, an aid to your thinking and writing done right. But there is also this question of like, I am now in the for-profit speech writing business. And I had a call with a prospective client where he said, we spent the past 6 weeks feeding a bunch of stories into ChatGPT, and we feel like what we have is pretty good. It's missing some stuff. And I ended up essentially helping to punch up an algorithm-generated draft that wasn't especially colorful or human, but it flowed logically. It had clearly been trained on 20,000 commencement addresses and had the kind of cliches down. So both kind of from a financial perspective, from like a what is the value of what I'm doing perspective, I think it is kind of an open question. Are we going to ultimately be in a position where, you know, you're less a speech writer and more kind of a speech prompter, where you're asking you know, a large a machine learning algorithm to you know, generate something, and then you're saying, you know, not less of this, more of this, you know, needs to make more of a connection with the audience. Can you instead find a story that does X, where the value you're bringing is at least knowing, you know, what the shape of a good speech is? But you are sort of almost like when I was a junior writer starting out, and I had partners at my speech writing firm who could kind of sketch out a speech and leave me to fill in some of the holes. Like, is that where we're heading?
Well, I mean, it seems to me though that some of the things that you've said are the most challenging about speech writing, like structure and also the time-consuming research process, are the things that would be most easily automated. And for I related very much to you saying that your style like was a bit scattered and that sometimes you have so many thoughts, so many ideas, it can be difficult to sequence them logically. And so I'm thinking for someone like me, maybe if someone as logical as a computer could offer me something, and then I could say, this is how we make it human, or this is how I add something that brings out what I hope is the most important takeaway from this. It could be really great, but I think the point is that we have to not get lazy and outsource the wrong things. I think that's exactly what you're saying. Like, we shouldn't be outsourcing our humanity. We should be outsourcing the kind of rote tasks that we're doing.
Totally. Ideally, it's it enhances your thinking and your ability to, you know, wrestle with the argument you're making. But yeah, there's clearly, you know, there's the ethics of it. And I don't know if you saw, there's a big New York Magazine piece on, you know, that basically was like, college kids are cheating their way through, like, busted them for writing an AI generated paper, and they responded with an AI generated email apology, right? Like, just like, we're so
I
cooked,
saw
you
that.
know, the critical thinking is gone, you know. So I think fortunately you and I graduated undergrad within a year of each other, and I think are at least we're able to develop those skills such that hopefully we can kind of collaborate with AI tools in ways where it enhances but doesn't replace the kind of critical thinking and everything. But
So see,
we will see where we are.
millennials are here to save the day again.
As
We are
always,
from
yeah.
the pre-tech era. We had to dust off our Nintendos to get the cartridges to work. And we also know how to use ChatGPT, some of us better than others. I'm not one of the good ones.
There you go.
But no, I think you're making a really important point. And so is there one particular speech that you've written that you're the most proud of or that you feel had the greatest impact and you kind of still think about it fondly?
Yeah. The speech that comes to mind is not one I would have said when I was in the process of writing it because I spent a week like totally paralyzed and in my head, but it was a speech that President Obama gave to the Canadian Parliament in, this was June of 2016. So Trump was on the rise. It was actually Bernie and Hillary were still duking it out in the primary. It was right after Brexit. There was the height of the Syrian civil war. And I'm sure you recall, there was a lot of backlash from certain governors to the idea of welcoming Syrian refugees. And we were going to Canada. This was towards the end of the Obama administration. And, you know, this was like a full-throated, like, there are some countries where, you know, we have we're partners in a lot of respects, but maybe you have to like be a little careful, like, oh, Singapore, you know, we, you know, it's this incredible, innovative success story and, you know, talent and upward mobility and sort of shared, you know, the American dream, Singaporean dream. But like, maybe you don't like do a full-throated defense of liberal values because there's still some more authoritarian aspects of their system. And this speech was just going to kind of be like a let it rip, like Barack Obama extolling the benefits of liberal democracy and free trade and all these things that we shared. Yeah, and you know, that we shared with like, you know, the Americans and Canadians are like so much on the same page about a lot of these things. This was, you know, this was then, obviously different moment now. But after I spent a week being totally frozen, I dove into it and obviously it was a team effort, and the president actually, the section we had on Brexit, he like reworked. There was a 2-page, you know, on a legal, you know, notepad, just wrote out longhand kind of this extended argument, sort of acknowledging the dislocations that had led to something like Brexit, but also sort of a defense of globalization. And again, this was at a moment where you had Bernie and Trump sort of both from the left and right attacking some of the virtues of globalization and free trade. And we were going to Canada, which was just, we were so integrated. And it was such a example of the benefits of this kind of relationship. I ultimately put, you know, a lot into this speech that I, you know, had the privilege to contribute to. And in particular, we wanted to close on the, you know, the refugee issue because Canada had been such a leader in welcoming refugees from Syria. Yeah. Trudeau had gone to the airport and, you know, just really extended a hand. And at one moment, I was just kind of idly like, I wonder if there are any refugees like that are sitting members of parliament, again, in terms of like thinking about who the audience is that's going to be hearing this. And I think I just, you know, Googled, like, you know, refugee Canadian parliament or something. Turned out, I think I found it. It's like a HuffPo article, but this member, her name was Mariam Monsef, and she was actually in Trudeau's cabinet as well as minister for like gender and families or something. And she had fled Afghanistan in the 80s and had this incredible story. You know, she left by like donkey and camel and plane. And so that, you know, became kind of the emotional climax that like seeing Canadians open their hearts and their homes to refugees in the present, in part because they recognized how much immigrants and refugees give back to our countries, like this woman sitting among you who fled Afghanistan by camel and donkey and jet plane and arrived in this country to the helping hands and the sounds of robins singing. You know, I did a whole thing of just this. Now she serves in this parliament and in this cabinet because Canada's her home.
And then
she
she's
got,
like, excuse me, there were no robins.
that came from something she had said in this article I found. I was one of the challenges whenever you have one of these kind of shout outs, it's like, you want to make sure they're in the room. And Secretary Blinken, I used to hate it when we'd be like, oh, is Undersecretary so-and-so here? And then there's like crickets. And so we'd be like trying to make sure. So for this Canadian parliament speech, there were all these other things. There had been an attack on airport in Istanbul, like other things that like last minute I was juggling, but I just kept checking with the embassy, like, is she going to be there? And they, you know, assured me she would. And ultimately when he concluded, gave her this shout out, she got like a 1 minute standing ovation from all her fellow members of parliament. And she was in tears and it was just like a really special moment to, and going back to the research, it was something I obviously was not the only person contributing to to this set of remarks. They were, the president's words, and he did a lot to shape them. But Canada was already being incredibly generous when it came to welcoming refugees. I have no evidence that, that made Canadians be like, yes, like we should welcome more. And, the US certainly, it's not like we threw open our doors as a result. So it's hard to measure the tangible impact per se, but at least in the room, it was very well received. People, Obama walked off to chants from members of parliament of 4 more years,
Oh my gosh.
which, doesn't tend to happen in,
Well, there's
at
an
a
impact,
rally.
but I mean
I'm sure
also
Canadian members of parliament would have been more than happy to elect him for a third term. So,
Yeah. No, but I think that when you talk about impact, it can be hard to measure, but also part of speech writing and communicating is contributing to, as you mentioned before, a shared understanding of reality. And so, like, that's what this project is all about. What is the outcome of this project? I have no idea, but I just always think telling the truth is a good thing, and recording a nuanced version of the truth where people have the time to unpack what they really think and why is everything. And it's kind of exactly what we need right now to counterbalance the other side. So that leads me into my last question for you, even though 20 more have popped into my head while we've been talking. I have to restrain myself. What is your greatest hope for the future?
I think my greatest hope is that it is still possible to like construct that shared reality, to connect with people from very different backgrounds, whether that's just someone from an opposing political party in our own country, or whether you were talking to young South Asian leaders in Indonesia, that we can find some common understanding of the world that we all inhabit and the challenges that we face and solutions that point the way forward and persuade people that the course of action that you are advocating is the right one. You mentioned in your introduction of me that I, had the really wonderful opportunity to be on the roller coaster ride of the Mayor Pete's presidential campaign. And this is somebody who could not be more different than Donald Trump, not to get, overly partisan, but a gay, multilingual, millennial veteran mayor from, the industrial Midwest. And we had something like 50 plus, I think it was 53 Republican precinct captains in Iowa at one point. These were people, in a lot of cases, who had pulled the lever for Donald Trump, who was nothing like Pete Buttigieg. And he, because he's such a gifted communicator, and that is like 110% him, and I basically get some unearned credit for just like riding along his coattails, but he was able to meet people where they were and acknowledge the very real frustrations and fears that they had, that maybe led them to support a different candidate, a different party, and then just sound so incredibly reasonable and thoughtful in the course, the future that he was advocating, that people who you would like to say just they'll never believe X, they're in this Twitter bubble, they're not even going to hear about this or that event, that he was able to find those people and reach them in some way, such that in some cases they weren't just voting but wanted to be even more involved in the campaign. And so I think I wish it didn't take sort of generational communicators, an Obama, a Buttigieg, to to cross that divide. But I think the thing that gives me hope is that those people are out there. There are ways to break down, those silos, and maybe it's starting with, uncles and cousins in your own family. Maybe it's a bigger audience, but I would like to believe still that that kind of we are able to transcend this moment and these divisions. So I just have to hold on to that. Otherwise, public service is a tough job under the best of circumstances, and I think you've got to have some faith that there's something better ahead.
For sure. And I think your point is beautiful. We can't write each other off. We really can't, but we can write.
Literally,
We
yes.
can just
We have to write
write.
so that we don't write people off.
And so I'm so glad that you continue to write. I'm so happy that you sat and talked to me today. And I just want to thank you for being a part of this project. And thank you so much for your service, Zev.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you again for this opportunity for making the space. It's
Of
really, really
course.
great.
And Pete, if you're listening, you're welcome to join me.
Well, I'll be sure to pass that on. He's on a
Perfect.
lot of podcasts these days.
Right up his alley. All right. Thanks, Ev.
Thanks.